Good morning, everyone.
I'm going to call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. A couple of housekeeping things. I know we have some members that are listening to our presentation. We are going to be taking some of the bills out of order as they are on the agenda. The first bill that we're going to start with will be Senate Bill 797. And then we will then go to Senate Bill 658. And then we will pick up the last two that we have under the public hearings. I do want to put on the record that we have a work session. I'm going to go ahead and just open that up right now. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 945. This is a carryover from yesterday. We're going to carry this bill over again. What we're waiting for is the paperwork from fiscal, and I believe we got the revenue stuff, but just the fiscal office. And we will continue to carry that bill over until we actually have that paperwork before we can move that out. The last thing I want to just put on the record, as of yesterday, Senator Boquist is on military duty. That is why he's not here today. And so he is excused from any votes that we have today. And with that, I'll close that work session on Senate Bill 945, carrying it over till tomorrow, which will be April 1st. And then we're going to go ahead and open up our first public hearing, which is going to be on Senate Bill 797. And Council, if you give us a little overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 797 is from the Department of Justice. It changes the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account to the Department of Justice Protection and Education Revolving Account. It adds civil rights lawsuits, unlawful trade practices suits, and criminal environmental lawsuits to the antitrust suits that are funded by the account. It declares emergency effective on passage. There is an amendment expected on this one.
All right, thank you. Yeah, and today, for everyone who is following, I believe at least this bill and possibly the next one that we do will be public hearing only. I don't think we have all the documentation we need anyway if we wanted to move forward. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and call up Senator Walker, Attorney General Kroger, and Fred Boss. Senator? Attorney General.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. Thanks for having us here this morning. I'm testifying on behalf and in support of Senate Bill 797 and would like to give the committee a brief overview of the motivations and functions of this piece of legislation. As the committee is aware, consumer protection is one of the core missions of the Department of Justice and one of my highest priorities as Attorney General. Since 2003, the Department has not received general funds to support its consumer protection effort. The consumer protection effort is self-funded through settlements and fines and fees that we receive in our consumer protection litigation. And the mechanism that allows us to self-fund is the Consumer Protection and Education Account, or CP&E account, which we're proposing to modify today. The CP&E account functions in a very simple and straightforward manner. When we receive settlements as part of our litigation on behalf of consumers in the state, those monies are placed in the Consumer Protection and Education account. Those funds are then used for three major functions. First, to provide restitution to victims who are victimized by the particular scheme or scam in question that gave rise to the litigation. Second, to fund consumer outreach and education efforts, such as the Scam Alert Network that we recently put in place, designed to help inform consumers about potential risks so that fewer people are victimized. And third, we use the funds to cover the costs of salaries and operational and administrative expenses for our consumer protection effort. And that last is why the consumer protection effort is self-funded rather than covered by general funds. We pay our expenses out of the settlement. The proposed legislation makes three fairly technical changes to the CP&E account, but three that I think are very valuable, and I'd like to summarize them quickly. First of all, when I came into the department in January, I discovered that we had a small operational surplus in the CP&E account. This is the result of really some tremendous litigation efforts that resulted in some very big settlements on behalf of the state and the citizens of the state. It will sound, I think, perhaps hopelessly naive to veterans of state government, but I believe when an agency has surplus funds beyond those necessary to perform the functions which have been assigned to the agency by the legislature, that those funds should be returned to the general fund. And I discovered in the process of that discussion that I don't have the legal authority to return a surplus in the CP&E account to the general fund. This struck me as a shortcoming, particularly in times like these when every single dollar in state government is essential. So one thing this bill would do is authorize and indeed require the department to return any operational surplus it has in the CP&E account to the general fund so that those monies can be reallocated by the legislature in ways that serve the public. Second, the bill reforms our operations in one area, and that is the area of Cypre restitution. Typically, when we receive a settlement, the majority of the funds that we receive go to the victims of the particular scheme. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, those victims are very easy to identify, and we work very hard to get them their share of the restitution to make them whole. In a very small number of cases, however, we've had trouble doing that, and they really fall into two categories. One are cases where it's impossible to determine precisely who was victimized. And second, there are some cases where you have so many victims that restitution would be effectively meaningless if it was provided evenly across all people in the class. I'll just give you a hypothetical case. If there was a consumer protection matter that affected virtually everyone in the state and our settlement was $3.5 million, we'd be effectively providing in restitution $1 to every citizen of the state, which would be more or less meaningless. What we have done in the past in that very small number of Cypre cases is instead of providing direct restitution to victims, we've effectively tried to create a grant program that would achieve the goals of the settlement by providing money either to another agency of state government or to a nonprofit organization that would help provide either education and assistance to people who've been victimized more generally in that area or to achieve some other goal related to the litigation. In conversations with Senator Walker, I think we both came to the conclusion that it would be more appropriate in those cases where we can't provide direct restitution to individuals to return any restitution to the general fund and let the legislature make the decision about how those funds could best be used to serve the citizens of the state. And so I think that's another improvement to the operation of this account. Third, it is my hope that the department will be more of a presence in three critical areas of law enforcement in the future. One of them is environmental crimes, where currently the state is, I think, behind where it needs to be. Second, in civil rights enforcement. And third, in securities fraud against major corporations who mislead investors. I've got a proposal pending in front of the Ways and Means Committee to expand general fund support for these in these three areas for the department's operation. But it is my hope in the future we would not need to seek as much general funding, but would be able to offset the general funds needed to sustain our operations in these areas by using the fines and penalties and settlement dollars to support the operations of the department in these areas, similar to the way we've done that in consumer protection. And so this modifies the CP&E account to allow that to happen. So those are the three major reforms that we're proposing in this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Senator? John, are you going to be able to stay if we do the full panel?
Of course.
Okay. Senator.
Okay, thank you. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I want to thank the Attorney General for being responsive to my inquiries. This issue came up for me during a the Attorney General's testimony on his budget in our Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety, and Senator Whitsitt serves on that committee, and he may recall my asking about that. I felt that the legislature should be the one to determine where funds go for these Cypre cases where you don't know who the victim is or the amount is so de minimis, it would be silly to return it to everyone. So this was a problem for me because we're the ones who make those decisions. We as legislators should be the ones deciding where the money goes, not the Attorney General, not the governor. This came about, and I'll just give you a clear case, and I know the AG will probably kick me under the table, but I need to sort of
discuss, we're watching.
discuss that with you, and it was the Reliant Energy case, and it was when all those people in California were cooking up the energy crisis and charging people a lot of money. Well, the state of Oregon sued. I think it was a multi-state action, was it, Mr. Attorney General?
That's correct.
And so we got a chunk of change out of that. We got actually a total of $2.2 million was restitution ordered. And then there were some other funds that came through it. The total fund was $3.5. Well, gee whiz, guess where the money went? It went to the Department of Energy. And they decided what they were going to do with it, and some of that money was invested in a wind farm, which sent me through the roof, because this is, you know, wind farms are great, but this was a decision for the legislature as a whole to make, not for someone in the department, not for someone in the governor's office, not for someone in the Department of Justice. So I sort of took the Attorney General to task a little bit, respectfully so, and said, that's our job. So I'm going to draft a bill that says that will be our job. And he said, I think I can help you. So we are working together on this, and I think it's totally appropriate. And as Mr. Attorney General says, he wants to give the money back, and he can't, which is absolutely silly. So this is going to create a revolving fund that will allow that money to return. Additionally, he has indicated to me that they need a certain amount, two biennia worth of money, kept in the fund at all times so that they are prepared, ready, and able to go after any lawsuit that strikes their fancy as being quite important to Oregon. And I agreed to that, and that's all for you to discuss as well, to make sure they have sufficient resources to go after these cases that can bring in significant sums of money into the state. So that is my interest. They were not quiet when I heard the Attorney General say he needed some money to assist in environmental issues and going after polluters. And I heard that loud and clear for about a year prior to him taking office, and I think that resonated with Oregonians. So I think this bill is appropriate on many levels, and I really want to commend the Attorney General for thinking, having the foresight to think ahead about how he might assist the general fund and how he can also do his job that he's been charged to do as a constitutional officer of the state of Oregon.
Before we take questions, with all due respect, I just need to find out if a certified smart person needs to say anything. Fred?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Fred Voss, Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to assist in any technical questions that the committee may have.
I assume you're going to say that. With that, we have questions. I have Senator Dingfelder first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, panel. I appreciate, Senator, you bringing this bill forward. I do have a question for either of the Attorney General staff folks, and I'm not sure this is before your time, Mr. Kroger, but regarding the tobacco settlement, I know, and I was here when we were allocated that funding, and I seem to recall that was dedicated towards smoking cessation programs. So is it fairly typical or untypical with cases such as, you know, where there's class action lawsuits or, like you said, large-scale lawsuits, that there is sort of dedicated programs or funding versus the example that Senator Walker shared with us? I mean, I just, I don't, you know, have a history of all those lawsuits in the state, and is it typical or atypical that there's dedicated programs for those funds, and is that typically part of the lawsuit, or is that something that the legislature decides working with the Attorney General?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator, it's a little bit difficult to generalize, and Mr. Boss may expand on my comments, but the different categories of cases are handled a bit differently. The tobacco settlement is a beast of unique characteristics and has its own account. We do a large number of cases that involve pharmaceuticals and deceptive marketing of pharmaceuticals. Those funds all tend to go back right back into the Medicaid program. Part goes back to the federal government, part goes back to the Oregon Health Plan to try to expand coverage. So those are dedicated. The general consumer protection cases, the funds go into the CP&E account, and typically the way in which those monies are dispersed are uncontroversial, which is to say part goes to cover our salary and expenses, part will go directly to the victims of the particular case that were affected, part will go to our education and outreach effort. The number of cases like the Reliant case where there isn't an obvious victim to hand the money to are pretty rare. They tend to be in the utility area, in part because those are cases where you have the largest volume of victims, and thus the size of the settlement relative to the number of victims means that reimbursing the victims would be relatively meaningless. And it's those cases that Senator Walker and I agree it would be most appropriate to simply take that restitution money that's available and provide it to the general fund to let the legislature decide how that money should best be used. So I hope that answer is responsive. Each of those three areas has its sort of own unique set of rules.
Okay, thank you.
Questions on this side? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Probably more of a comment, but you know, I'm always concerned when agencies are allowed to use the proceeds of the fines and forfeitures that they impose. And there's at least that perception that in order to maintain that division, you have to continue to generate enough fines and forfeitures to support the cost of the division. I know that there are some NGOs and even some law schools around the country have taken that to a new art form of filing lawsuits, settling out of court, and recovering their attorney fees and their costs in order to support their situation. So I think that certainly in returning the surplus is a great idea, and I think we should always look very closely at those situations where we build an agency's function on the back of its fines and forfeitures.
Senator Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to sort of address the panel, and whomever wants to respond can. I can see the benefit of having, when there's a consumer protection case and that money comes back into this existing account and the efforts go to things like the scam alert, which, by the way, I get and really appreciate. I want to make sure that there's some safeguard to know whether the money staying in the account or going back to the general fund, that there's some connection between the money that comes back and the efforts in which it's expended. I wouldn't want to see, for example, money from a consumer protection case just to go somewhere that's not related. And I would like to see some safeguards to make sure that there is a connection between, in those CyPray cases, that there's a connection between the money and the purpose for which it's directed. So I don't know how you can address that or if you even agree with that comment.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bundy. It is certainly the intent in our Dash 1 amendments that the money that is given back to the legislature in those CyPray cases be distributed according to the terms of the judgment and terms of the settlement. So it'll be akin to federal funding. This is what we've had in our discussions with LC. There will be essentially strings attached. So for example, in the energy cases, the funds were given to the state of Oregon. for settlement in settlement of the energy cases to assist in energy-related issues in Oregon. So I think it is certainly our intent that in the Cypre cases that it would come, the funds would come to the general fund, but with the general string attached that the policy decision be made in that particular area, such as that it be used to assist Oregon in energy cases. The intent was to put the decision-making back with the Legislative Assembly on what those choices are rather than with the executive branch.
And if I might respond, and I appreciate Mr. Voss's comments, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonamici, let me use the Reliant Energy case as an example. And I will say that this Attorney General is not in place when this case happened. It was settled in 2007. And that money truly did belong to energy-related issues. And this is not to say that I might not have agreed with the decision that was made, but I wasn't chair of the committee, but here I am co-chair of the Natural Resources Committee with the Department of Energy's budget in my committee. And it should have been my committee's ability to review that settlement and decide best how to use the money. How it was used was to create a renewable energy feasibility fund to support feasibility studies for community renewable energy projects, and then it also created a community renewable energy feasibility program to encourage widespread adoption of renewable energy projects. Well, that might have been all well and good, but we had nothing to say about it, was my point. It was a deal that was worked out between the Attorney General and the Governor. That's not the way it should work. It really belongs with you as an elected representative electing your constituency. And I agree, if this is a case involving drug companies, then that money should probably go to the department, the agency that has the, let me start over, with the subcommittee that has the Department of Human Services budget that would address these issues, and then that committee would decide how that money would be spent. So it does come back to the general fund, but I think it should go to the appropriate subcommittees that can deal with the funds. When you specifically know where it goes, and I'm not sure I heard the Attorney General say this in response to Senator Dingfelder, but sometimes when they're involved in multi-state cases, they don't really have a choice about where that money goes. It's part of the settlement agreement, and you just live with it and you deal with it. But in other cases, we do have a choice where that money goes. And in that case, I want it to come back to the general fund. And I think we're trying to get there. But if we don't quite have enough sideboards there to meet your concern, we can work with that a little bit more.
We don't have
that
amendment.
Yeah. I have the draft.
Yeah. So let me follow up. I've got a couple of questions. The Dash ones may address this or not, but when you look at the original bill on page 1, starting on line 25, it talks about setting up that account. Then it says, are not subject to allotment. And so I just want to make certain that that's being addressed, because my understanding, if it's not subject to allotment, that basically defeats everything I just heard as to being able to have the money come back in if necessary for rebalancing or whatever it may be. So does someone want to tackle that one?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had the same exact question. What does this mean? And I got an answer back from the department, so I'm going to let the certified smart person from the department.
Which is apparently not me.
This is the elected certified smart person. This is the hired certified smart person. So Mr. Voss can answer that.
Yeah. Chair Brzezinski, that is terms inserted by legislative counsel as far as how this revolving account should work. And so those are technical budget terms that I understand are for the purpose to make a revolving account. And there doesn't have to be the allotment each biennia by the legislature.
Okay.
That is my understanding.
And well, we get clarification as to making sure it does what the intent would be and all that. The other thing is, knowing some of the areas that you're wanting to go into, knowing there's others that have dual jurisdiction of that, how's this going to work? I mean, are we in the sense of some of the civil rights stuff. I know that Boley already does some, the Secretary of State does some in different parts of this. Is there going to be a meeting of the minds as to who's doing what? Or are we looking at what I would consider a significant shift of moving one task for one executive branch department to another one?
Chair Brzezinski, no, absolutely not. In each of these areas, I think responsibilities are pretty clear, and we don't wish to change those significantly. For example, in the environmental crimes area, the Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for civil and administrative enforcement, but the enforcement of the criminal environmental laws are left to the Department of Justice and the district attorneys. So that those divisions are very clear. In the area of civil rights, the Bureau of Labor and Industries is clearly the predominant frontline protector of most of the discrimination laws in the state, and we have no interest in changing that whatsoever. I would expect, first, that there are some civil rights and civil liberties issues that fall outside the purview of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I could give some examples. Protection of a woman's right to choose, protection of our civil liberties under the First and Fourth Amendments are areas that are the responsibility of the Department of Justice. Second, it is my hope that we would identify with Boley a small number of discrimination cases that are more appropriately dealt with in the courts of the state rather than through an administrative process. And so we're hoping to work very closely with Boley to identify the cases that the commissioner feels would be appropriately dealt with in court. So I think that's going to be an ongoing discussion. But what we want to have here is the possibility of recouping some of the fines and penalties to help sustain the operations of the department in that area, in this area. I would say that in this area in particular, in civil rights, monetary recoveries are for the state are typically going to be very small, and that's because in these cases the overwhelming emphasis for any judgment that one can recover is to put that money in the hands of the person that is wronged. So in this area in particular, I think the amounts of recoveries the state will have in financial terms is going to be extraordinarily small, but we still thought it was appropriate as a housekeeping matter to have a place to put any such fines or penalties that we were able to collect in the future.
Okay, great. Last question.
Yes, please. Just, Mr. Attorney General, just in, I was looking at ORS 559.331, hoping it would be something kind of simple. And to my non-legal mind, it's not simple. Could in lay terms, could you tell us what you're trying to do with the that part of the Dash 1 Amendment?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Wizard, if I could address that. That allows the Department of Justice, 59331, allows the Department of Justice to enforce the state's security laws called the Blue Sky Laws. The primary regulator of the Blue Sky Laws, or the state securities laws, is the Department of Business and Consumer Services. In certain cases, the Attorney General is also allowed to enforce those laws, primarily working with the DCBS to, just as in the civil rights area that the Attorney General testified about, working with the DCBS to, in the appropriate circumstances, file a suit in civil court and to prosecute an actor, bad actor for securities fraud. It just gives the Attorney General limited authority in the securities area.
How does that change what's already in the statute?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Wizard, this provides a funding source for those activities.
Thank you.
All right. I don't think there's any other questions. Thank you all very much for being here. I have no one else that's signed up and scheduled to testify on Senate Bill 797. So I will ask, is there anyone here who has not signed up who wants to give testimony? Please come forward at this time.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Maluski, conservation coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. I'd like to arrive a little late so I didn't get to sign up. Would like to thank the Attorney General and Senator Walker for bringing this this important idea forward. The reason why I'm here today is to demonstrate, we have over 20,000 members in Oregon. I'd like to demonstrate some public support for the provisions in this revolving fund to be able to allow the Attorney General to effectively pursue criminal prosecutions for state and federal environmental laws. We believe it's very important the state dedicate the resources necessary to do environmental crimes work. It's great to have laws on the books, but if we don't have the resources to implement them, they're not good for very much. The state currently has very limited resources to pay for these types of cases, and this will hopefully give us a place to start. In response to, I believe, a concern that Senator Witsit raised, I don't believe we're going to see the nickel and diming of people here. This is really to allow the recouping of expenses of some of the fines and penalties to be able to pay for this work. And in terms of the criminal aspect here, we're looking at very serious, intentional, knowing cases of environmental pollution where people are knowingly polluting the environment, causing harm to other citizens. At that point, we believe that environmental crimes really almost becomes a civil rights issue. So we support the elements of this piece of legislation to allow the Attorney General to effectively fund this work and carry out this environmental crimes work.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, Ivan. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 797, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next one, which is going to be Senate Bill 658, opening that public hearing in council. Give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 658 grants campus security guards at OHSU, Oregon Health Science University, the powers of and authority of peace officers with the exception of the ability to carry firearms. There's an amendment expected on this one.
All right. Who took it? Okay. Apparently someone's left with our witness list. So I would
Senator
say.
Burdick.
And Senator Starr.
We'll start off with the electeds. That way at least we'll get everyone in and out that need to get in and out. We'll figure out where we go from there. So Senator Burdick, Senator Starr.
And Steve.
And Steve, thank you. And Representative Thatcher, are you here on this one too? Well, if you'd like to bring a chair up and join us, we definitely can do four in a panel. Thank you. All that for this, huh? Oh, yeah, I know. All right, so whoever wants to start off and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us today. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 658, which would grant special campus security officers at OHSU the powers and authority of peace officers and would provide for their training. Rather than talk too much about the legislation, I'd like to talk about how OHSU arrived at this recommendation that is embodied in Senate Bill 658. Like most universities across the country, or at least the smart ones, OHSU began reviewing its critical readiness following the campus shootings at Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois University. After a thorough internal analysis of the public safety officers' authorities at OHSU and their training and equipment, OHSU President Joe Robertson decided to form a public task force to consider whether additional steps were necessary to ensure the safety of the OHSU community. The Critical Incident Readiness Task Force was specifically asked to review the readiness to respond to a variety of critical incidents, including an active shooter at OHSU facilities on Markham Hill, South Waterfront, and its West Campus in Hillsboro. And as you all know who have been to OHSU, it's a very complex campus. It's hard to find your way around, even if you know where you're going. And so there are many challenges. And so I really commend Dr. Robertson for getting out in front of it. The makeup of the task force was broad and diverse. I was happy to serve as chair of this task force at Dr. Robertson's request. The groups represented on the task force include the Sheriff's Department of Multnomah County, the Portland Police Bureau, two neighborhood associations that touch OHSU, Markham Hill Campus, a community advocate, the Portland Mayor's Office, the Governor's Office, the OHSU Patient Advocate, OHSU Faculty and Students, the Urban League, the Portland Business Alliance, the VA Hospital, AFSCME, Oregon Nurses Association, OHSU Health System, and the OHSU Board of Directors. I might note that the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Multnomah, was offered a seat but did not elect to participate, but did have comments on the report after it was done. The task force met four times and had public testimony during all those times and expert testimony. We reviewed studies of the Virginia Tech shootings and other national reports on campus safety, as well as the current response to an active shooter at OHSU and the likelihood of an incident at OHSU. The task force heard some truly alarming facts, including the numerous studies that show an active shooter injures or kills four people per minute until he or she is stopped. This continues until the shooter is engaged by an armed law enforcement officer. Portland Police is the current armed response to if there were an active shooter on the Markham Hill campus or South Waterfront. Discussions with the Portland Police Bureau Command and analysis of response times to actual emergency calls suggest it would take at least 15 minutes to assemble the five-person contact team and arrive at Markham Hill to engage an active shooter. They're highly, highly trained. They have protocols for these situations, and to get the proper team in place, we're talking 15 minutes. While the first arriving unit could be on scene in less than 7 minutes, an additional 8 minutes would elapse before the entire required tactical team of five officers could be assembled. And what was especially alarming to me, and I think to others as well, OHSU conducted an analysis of what we call attractors to help assess its exposure to a potential active shooter situation. And because of its complexity and the thousands of daily visitors, the high-stress environment, it has a level one trauma center, emergency room, there are all these factors. OHSU has a high level of attractors, and so it is at more risk than perhaps other institutions of having this type of tragic situation occur. Between the large number of attractors and the slow response time, the task force felt that the status quo was unacceptable. As you all know, the current security staff at OHSU are not fully trained as police officers. They are unarmed, and they do have the use of tasers, but they are not equipped either by training or equipment to handle themselves an active shooter. So at this point, I will defer to my colleague, Senator Bruce Starr, a member of the task force, to describe specifically the recommendations that we came up with.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr. I represent the communities in western Washington County of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains. I was also a member of the public task force convened by Dr. Robertson and chaired by Senator Burdick. She was right to describe the task force as large and diverse, and I would like to add that the City of Hillsborough and the Hillsborough Police Department were also represented. The OHSU West campus is in Hillsborough in my district and was a vital part of the study that the task force conducted. Senator Burdick described the situation. I should add that we had a tremendous amount of background reports and materials for the committee to review. Based on the evidence we heard, the task force reached several conclusions. First, the task force concluded that the current response to an active shooter on OHSU campus is unacceptably low and slow. Second, the group believes the safety on the OHSU campus could be enhanced by establishing a permanent presence of certified armed law enforcement officers with additional specialized training to deal with vulnerable populations, including the mentally ill. The task force considered and rejected several options for responding to an active shooter incident. These rejected options include, number one, maintaining the status quo, two, encouraging the Portland Police Bureau to modify its existing tactical doctrine to speed up response, and three, hiring armed security guards who are not sworn law enforcement officers. These were viewed as unworkable or insufficient in terms of response. The task force did make two recommendations. Recommendations one, OHSU should seek a change to the state statute governing OHSU's public safety officers to clarify their roles and authorities regardless of whether it moves forward with the recommendation to establish an armed presence. Recommendation two, a full-time armed law enforcement presence should be established at OHSU in order to provide a faster response to an active shooter incident, provided that a number of conditions are met. Some of the conditions include all armed officers have completed a 16-week DPSST academy, all armed officers complete supplemental OHSU campus public safety training, all armed officers complete a 40-hour critical incident training developed and conducted by the Portland Police Bureau. The majority of task force members recommended OHSU seek a change in statute that would allow it to employ its own armed law enforcement officers. The task force would also support OHSU contracting with local police department to establish an armed presence at OHSU, and the university is pursuing the second option. To reiterate, the membership on the task force was inclusive and it studied, and the study it conducted was exhaustive. On behalf of the task force, I urge you to support Senate Bill 658. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you. For the record, I'm State Representative Kim Thatcher from House District 25, covering Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am here today in support of Senate Bill 658 because it gives the Oregon Health and Sciences University something that I wish all the universities in our state could have, and that would be a way of choosing how they want to handle campus security. As you may know, I'm working on with several other members of the House on similar legislation on which would give all the other public universities in Oregon the option of training and equipping their campus security officers so that they can become full-fledged police officers, but it's only if those universities make an individual choice to do so. To aid in the discussion, I have some hot-off-the-press amendments that are still probably warm and weren't necessarily everything that I wanted, but I wanted to leave them there for discussion. And it would, the point of these amendments would be to, for your consideration, would be to allow each university in the state to decide their own destiny for campus security. It allows OHSU to keep the path they would like to pursue for their particular situation, and it would open the door for other universities to do the same. These amendments would not impose mandates on the university system and would not force any campus to do anything. Last session, the House passed a bill requiring all campuses to elevate their campus officers to the level of police officer, giving them full training in firearms. This time around, understanding especially the current budget environment we are in, we applaud OHSU's efforts to do their own thing and would like to see other universities have that same option. We have already seen this tradition of local control in action across the state over the past few decades. For example, OSU has made a choice to spend the money necessary to contract with state police officers to protect their campus. That's in addition to the regular campus officers already on duty. At the University of Oregon, they have a similar contract with the Eugene Police. In fact, the State Board of Higher Education, at their March meeting a year ago, had a lengthy discussion about how each campus had recently undergone a safety review and engaged student and faculty input. They talked about the fact that a couple of universities in the system wanted more local control and wanted to change the way they were doing things, but they needed legislation to do that. As we started working on the House bills in the interim, we did hear from a couple of OHSU campus safety officers who wanted more flexibility and wanted to give Pill Hill the protection it deserves by allowing them to elevate their status to police officers. We know many of our campuses are like small cities. In fact, oftentimes it's hard to figure out where the campus begins and the city sidewalk ends. There are some who feel our universities shouldn't be in the business of running a police department, but consider there already are campus safety departments in each location. at our universities. So giving OHSU's officers a name change and more training isn't going to change much in the way of their operations. But I do urge and support, with or without amendment, Senate Bill 658, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Prezansky, members of the committee, my name is Steve Statham. I'm Executive Vice President of Oregon Health and Science University, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 658. First of all, I want to say that we fully support the work of the task force, and I also want to publicly thank Senators Burdick and Starr for their service. We would definitely request that OHSU be able to professionalize its public safety program. Our sheer size and complexity does call for commissioned public safety officers with comprehensive law enforcement training to handle everything responding to emergencies, investigating crimes, submitting requests for warrants to judges for OHSU-related matters, and preparing cases for prosecutors. Although OHSU agrees that now is the time to develop a fully professionalized university police department with trained and commissioned police officers, it has concluded that it will not issue firearms to its officers. Instead, we intend to seek out contracting relationships with an established police agency to provide police services that require the use or potential use of firearms. We think that is the better way to go. However, it is essential that a professional police unit be fully trained and certified as police officers with comprehensive training in arrest procedures, investigations, use of force, reporting requirements, and all other standards that govern police departments in this state. Our expectation and intent for this bill is that university police officers receive this training in the same regular course as other police officers at our expense. We would note in particular that the current OHSU statute says that campus security officers are not police as defined by the state's police training statute in ORS 181.610. That specific reference was struck in this bill, and the purpose of striking it was to make clear that OHSU officers will receive the necessary training and certification as police, even though they won't carry or use firearms. And just to address a couple points of information, we currently obviously operate a 24/7 police or campus security system with three shifts, and we have 24 officers, six sergeants, and then six DSPTT trained managers. So that's the size. So on any given shift with vacations or sick leave, you might see, and again, three campuses, probably seven, eight, or nine officers in total. We are intending to initially ramp up our training. Our goal would be able to, if the bill were to pass, would be to have two officers trained per 16-week academy until we were fully trained. We do have video cameras on our campuses that are monitored by public safety. They're not everywhere, but in appropriate places, and certainly in places like the emergency rooms and emergency department. We also have alarms and electronic door locks on some of our newer buildings. Unfortunately, not all of our buildings have those. They're pretty expensive to install in older buildings, and those are also monitored by our public safety officers. And then we do intend and have been exploring technologies to help alert the campus in situations where there might be a critical incident, such as what Senators Burdick and Starr described. That technology is not in place yet. It's expensive, and not all of it is interactive with all the technologies that we currently use in the modern world, such as texting and paging and our computer screens. The one we're most interested in is probably the one that would reach the most people quickly, which would be one that would take over a computer screen and say, you know, alert, lock your doors, or something has happened. And we are exploring that. We don't have additional discretionary capital dollars right now to install it, but we have been investigating that. I would like to note that a change was made to the concept of this bill at the drafting level, and we're going to be working with legislative counsel to try to get the bill amended technically to return to the original concept. The draft retains the older reference to security officers, which our experience teaches us is not an effective peacekeeping tool for OHSU, and we are going to be working with legislative counsel to propose amendments that clarify what our intent is, which would be that the OHSU campus security officers be trained, certified, and commissioned as university police officers, as I described. thank you for allowing me to testify. It's very important to OHSU. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right, I'm going to open up the panel for questions. Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. It's my understanding that the Portland police have a requirement that they have at least 5 armed officers on hand before they intervene in an active shooting. I wonder how well that would work in rural Oregon. Is that common among other municipalities? And which police agency would you contract with that would alleviate this problem?
Senator Woodsett, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I can't speak to how common it is, but I do know that most urban environments, they do have team training and team procedures for engaging with a shooter or somebody like that. I agree in a rural setting it's probably not realistic or achievable. One of the reasons for that is in an urban situation, like OHSU or another university, there are just a lot of people around, and so managing people and containing movement is important. In terms of other agencies we might talk to, we haven't settled on that. We haven't actually opened up any discussions. We didn't want to be presumptuous about this bill. I know that we're considering talking to Multnomah County and potentially the state police. Obviously, you have to have a willing partner, and everybody has budget challenges and things like that. And in this case, we would be paying essentially for a contracted services, and we'd like to pay as little as we can, and I'm sure they want to fully recover their costs. And we haven't opened those discussions, Senator.
Just a brief follow-up then. If you were going to contract with an agency that still has a similar requirement, as I recall Senator Burdick's testimony, that's about 15 minutes would be about, there'd be about 60 fewer people to worry about if they had that much ammunition. So again, I would wonder why we wouldn't provide firearms to these individuals so that they could intervene immediately rather than wait for 15 minutes.
Senator Woodsett, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, just to clarify, what we'd be talking about is having that contract service on our campus and integrated into our public safety system up there. So our director of public safety would oversee the contract, and they would be, in a sense, leased employees from, let's say, Multnomah County, and they would be integrated with our safety officers. And they would have a division of duties. And so, for example, we have very much a community policing approach at OHSU, and many of our public safety officers would continue to do what they're doing, which is, frankly, helping people with directions or dealing with a family that needs to assistance figuring out where to go or what services are available while they're waiting for, their loved one to get care, that sort of thing. We would have the, let's say Multnomah County would actually lease to us staff that would be supervised by our director of public safety. It's just that they would be employed by an agency that's already trained and has overall responsibility for those employees. So we wouldn't have the 15-minute delay. That is the key point. The key point the task force concluded was it would be unacceptable, and we have to have a presence physically on our campus that enables a more expedient response in that situation. Thank you.
All right. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the task force for tackling this issue. I sat on the House Health Care Committee that considered the bill that Representative Thatcher mentioned, and it was interested enough in the issue that over the interim I attended a two-day conference on campus security. And of course, OHSU is in a very unique situation because it's urban but it's not urban, and it's a campus but it's more than a campus. And so I really applaud you for considering all those factors about OHSU and coming up with this proposal that we all, of course, hope will work and prevent problems. But it's a complex issue, and as we all know, with Virginia Tech, they had armed security, and we can't be led to the sense of if we just arm everybody, there won't be problems, because there's a lot of other issues that we need to look at, including issues with the confidentiality of medical and educational records. And that was a lot of the problem at a school like Virginia Tech, where there wasn't enough communication because there were impediments to teachers who recognized problems with the students communicating with others on the campus. So it's much more complex than it may look on the surface. And also, Mr. Statham, thank you for mentioning the advances that you're making in technology. And at the conference, there was a lot of information about the technological advances, including cameras that speak when there's somebody in the parking lot that maybe, I don't know how the camera knows that it's a suspicious person, but pretty high tech, and also the alert methods that are using text messaging and computers are critically important to preventing further problems. So it's a big picture thing. I did want to mention that there was a mention in the conference about Department of Homeland Security funding for campus security. So I don't know if that's something that's still available. I mean, it has been a while since the conference, but there may be some resources available for that type of security. But there's a lot of things that need to be done to prevent problems from happening. And it isn't all solved by arming security, but I want to say thank you for all your work on this.
All right. I'm going to make a couple of comments before we take the next panel. Let me just put it on the record as to my perspective on this. I've been working on this issue for three sessions at least with the University of Oregon. I've made a commitment to a lot of the different campuses around the state that we'll have an interim work group. We are, in fact, going to hopefully be able to come back to the next full session with a complete plan for the state as a whole. There's multiple models that are out there that could be individual autonomously at each university, or it could be something that we may choose a different model that could be a unit of the state police, just using that as an example, that would be available for all of the state facilities. There's a lot of things that we need to look at. There's multiple models, and I think I may have someone who will be joining me on that interim work group since she's already dabbled in the area. So that's kind of where we're at. It is something that I believe all of us want to get something done, but we need to make certain we look at all of the pros and cons. What's the best fit for Oregon? Is it have individual campuses do their own thing, or is it something we want more unified? So with that, thank you all very much for coming forward, and again, thank you on the task force, because it definitely has put us to the point of where we'll be able to hopefully succeed with everyone by the end of this next session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I also had Cameron Campbell. please come on up. And was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 658? Cameron, thank you for being here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Cameron Campbell. I'm the Director of Training for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And a little bit of historical background, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training has worked with the various public safety departments of the Oregon University system, as well as the Oregon Health Sciences University Department of Public Safety for many years. In the past, DPSST has offered voluntary campus public safety course that is 5 weeks in length and on a fee-for-service basis to colleges and universities across the state. Among the topics covered are criminal law, defensive tactics, report writing, civil liability, health and fitness, hazardous materials, police procedures, and several other classes related to public safety and security issues on college campuses. DPSST is neutral on this particular legislation, but we can provide a little bit of additional background on this. And there is some legislative action that would be required if the role of these particular people is to change. Currently, there is no legislative definition of a campus public safety officer in DPSST's statutes. Campus public safety officers do not currently meet the definition of police officer in ORS 181.610, subsection 14, nor do they work for a law enforcement unit, as defined in ORS 181.610, subsection 12. This bill would give Oregon Health Sciences University campus public safety officers all of the powers and authority of peace officers, and would require that these officers attend the 16-week basic police course, but not allow them to carry firearms. Senate Bill 658 requires DPSST to provide training and certification, but does not add them to the definition of police officer or recognize them as a law enforcement unit within our statutes. We're also looking at the portion of the bill that retains a provision that OHSU may contract with any state agency for the duties as appropriate and whether or not that applies to the DPSST training as well. It would, of course, prohibit us from charging any amount greater than the actual cost of the services, and we would need a little more direction with that. Senate Bill 658 appears to express intent to make Oregon Health Sciences University campus public safety officers police officers within DPSST statutes, since RS 180-1610 will no longer be listed among the statutes for which they are not police officers. And that was pointed out earlier, but that is only that change is only in 353050 and not in any of DPSST statutes. And so that would need to that fix would need to happen in order for them to be recognized. Because they are not covered within our statutes, we would not have the authority to certify them as police officers, if that is the intention of this particular bill. If, however, the intent is to retain a special category of campus public safety officers other than police officers, and that's unclear to us right now, a new section would need to be added to our statutes, granting DPSST the authority to develop new minimum standards or to impose the current minimum standards that apply to police officers to this special category. The current law does not give us the ability to verify that they meet the minimum standards before they would be required to attend DPSST basic police course, and that is a piece that we would need to fix as well. DPSST is also concerned about the impact the changes made in this bill will have on our organization as a whole. The economic downturn has already reduced our budget programs by approximately 20%. And forced a reduction in the number of basic police classes that will be offered over the next biennium. DPSST already has a backlog of city, county, and state law enforcement officers who need to attend the 16-week basic police course. This legislation, as you heard, is going to add dozens of individuals to that backlog already. And we anticipate that the number of classes that we will be offering the way it looks right now for the next biennium is not going to be enough to meet the demand. Our assumption is that these officers would be scheduled for the classes the same as all other officers, which mean that all of the paperwork that is necessary, the medical examination, all of the background paperwork, things like that, would need to be submitted prior to the officers being scheduled. We do look forward to working with the members of the Legislative Assembly and Oregon Health Sciences University in addressing this, and I am thank you for your consideration, and I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have, if I can.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Do you have a short first name or your
name?
Senator Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Mike Silver. I am part of the National Committee for Campus Safety that's sponsored by the Community Policing Program and the Bureau of Justice. I am also a member of SEIU and a working public safety officer. Prior to that, I was a police officer in the state since 1990. I hope to answer some of your questions. Senator Bonamici brought up about the Homeland Security grants. Those grants are not available to most public safety agencies because we are not considered a law enforcement unit. You talked about committees and different work sessions that can and will happen in the future. A lot of these work sessions have already happened. The governor had a governor's task force that met over the last year, which made its recommendations. However, the scope of that task force was very limited. OHSU is unique, as well as the Oregon University system, universities throughout the state are unique. We should be able to have that choice. As a working public safety officer in the field, working with the students, working with the people that come on campus with drugs, guns, knives, and various different warrants, we should have the ability to receive the training and the support and the protections under the Oregon Revised Statutes that we do not currently have. The Oregon Revised Statutes at this time are very confusing when it comes to us. As you heard Mr. Campbell talk about, there's no clear definition as to who we are. We have probable cause arrest authority. We can take away someone's freedom at this time. However, we can't issue them a single citation for minor in possession. We cannot issue a simple citation for possession less than an ounce. If we have a student who's been drinking on campus and they're with a non-student, we have no alternative but to call on the local authorities and they both get criminal cites. We cannot change that to where one person go to judicial conduct on campus and the non-student get a criminal cite. We don't have that authority to do that, but we have the authority to arrest. We have the requirement to arrest, except for matters of domestic violence. There is so much confusion, and it has been that way for so long, that now's the time to act. Now's the time we need to look at the order and advice statutes and the history that is occurring and continuing in this country and make those changes. I know for myself, as a public safety officer, as an SEIU member, and someone that's been working on this bill for over 4 years, not only here in the state of Oregon, but nationally, I urge your support for this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 658. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a bill that we carried over from yesterday, because I think it will be pretty quick. SJM 12. And I remember correctly, I think Paul Snyder was here yesterday, was going to give testimony, Mr. O'Leary. And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on SJM 12? Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. It's a pleasure to be here before you today. You'll recall a few weeks ago, this pretty much same panel came before you to testify on Senate Bill 93, which is a related bill. Senate Joint Memorial 12 is a memorial for your consideration by which the Oregon legislature would urge Congress to move on the legislation that's been previously introduced to allow states to implement federal tax refund intercepts for the collection of unpaid court fines and fees. This memorial kind of goes through the major points as follows. There's $1 billion of unpaid restitution fines and fees and criminal penalties ordered in Oregon state courts, providing federal authorization to tap into federal tax returns would greatly enhance enforcement of those orders. According to the Judicial Department, the number that they've estimated is that would see about $60 million a biennium flow into Oregon. They base that on the model that they use currently to collect child support enforcement payments, which are authorized by federal law out of federal tax refunds. This, by the way, the way the federal bill is being drafted, it would come second in line after child support. Under Oregon law, those dollars that are paid into the criminal fines and fees, roughly about half of them benefit the local community where the fine or fee was imposed, the city, the county, that jurisdiction. The other half goes into the criminal fines and assessment account, the CFAA, which those of you that sit on Ways and Means are very familiar with. These are funds that are used to support law enforcement training at DPSST, to benefit the victims of crime at programs through the Department of Justice, and to support criminal investigations through the Oregon State Police. The remainder that is not used for those purposes reverts to the State General Fund. So this is would be a huge impact to Oregon at a time when those dollars are greatly needed, and I'm happy to be here to answer any questions you might have, and on behalf of the governor, urge you to move this bill to the floor.
All right, thank you. Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Lemon from the State Judicial Department. You should have a letter from the Chief Justice Paul DeMunis in your file supporting this measure. The Chief Justice has been working with his colleagues throughout the country and with the National Center on State Courts to move federal legislation as well as his efforts here. And just to echo what Joe said, we support this measure because we believe that it will increase enforcement of court orders and add to the public trust and confidence in the justice system. It will increase the accountability of offenders and also increase revenue to state and local governments and to crime victims. So appreciate your support.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and for all the reasons you've already heard, we support SJM 12.
Great, thank you. Is there any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming back, and I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SJM 12. We're opening up our last public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 285. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 285 requires the State Board of Pharmacy to reclassify marijuana as a Schedule II controlled substance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to ask for an additional chair to come forward, and what I for four people. So if someone could bring a chair up, I have Jerry Wade, Lee Berger, John Sejo, and Brian Michaels. Gentlemen, that's fine. I think that's all we need. Let me just let you know, we have about 17 minutes, I'm going to say 15 minutes before we need to be done, so if you can limit your testimony so we can get everyone in, that'd be great. And who wants to start?
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Wade, and I'm here today representing the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. And our foundation is currently working on several pieces of legislation this session, but we were here to support the passage of Senate Bill 285. This is something that's been an actively sought goal of the medical marijuana community for as long as I can remember. And it would be a clarification and a cleanup bill, actually, that would bring this law into compliance or into out of conflict with our current medical marijuana law, which says marijuana is medicine and this says it isn't. And I had a lengthy conversation with this Board of Pharmacy, and they were able to get back with me after consulting with many of their members, and their opinion is they are currently neutral on this bill. They have no opinion.
They're actually here, so we'll hear from somebody.
But one of the things they were also telling me is they saw there was no conflict. They said that much of what they do is commonly dictated by legislation, and if this committee was to go forward with this bill, there would be nothing that would prevent them from carrying out that action.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Brian will be next, and then for Lee and John, we have just a few minutes. I want to make sure everyone gets an opportunity to testify and see if there's anyone else, so if you can limit your comments and not repeat each other, that'd be great.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pruszynski. Other members, my name is Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney here in Oregon, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. I travel and practice around the state on a lot of medical marijuana issues, both defending people and as well as suing on behalf of people who have had their rights violated under the medical marijuana program. And marijuana is, as we know, a long-term hot-button issue, which is more and more emerging as an even greater hot-button issue. Generally, my comments would revolve around the politics and science of marijuana, but in this case, I think the argument is quite clear. The bill is one line. It deserves one line. There is a medical marijuana program in Oregon, Schedule II, recognizes that there's a medical use for marijuana. The laws are simply in conflict. There is no way to reconcile that conflict other than to schedule the marijuana in the way that the medical marijuana statutes dictate. The Federal Controlled Substance Act, of course, leaves marijuana in a Schedule I. One of the hot-button issues of marijuana is the issue of states' rights. As we know, California and Oregon are leading the charge in that regard, and this is an issue of state rights. And we as Oregonians have gone down this road before, and there's no reason to not go down this road here. We say in the state of Oregon there is a medical use for marijuana. The feds say there is not. We don't have to follow the feds. We are the state of Oregon. We recognize medical use. Schedule II is a recognition of medical use. The story is closed. The laws have already been passed. This is more of a house cleaning bill than anything else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee or John, whoever.
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm also a lawyer. I live and work in Portland in Senator Carter and Representative Shields' district. I also practice statewide representing patients and their providers. I do other legal work as well. For me, this legislation is a very long time coming. I started practicing in 1983, and one of the first cases I worked on was a case where we challenge through a thing called a demurrer, where you challenge the indictment, the classification of marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance. We put on evidence at a hearing in Multnomah County in the circuit court from the head of oncology at Kaiser Permanente about the medical, the anti-emetic qualities for nausea associated with chemotherapy. And we were unsuccessful in the courts 25 years ago. There is a case in the Court of Appeals, State versus Eels, E-E-L-L-S, which says, consistent actually with Mr. Michael's representations, that the State Board of Pharmacy is free to follow different criteria than the federal law. And if the federal law says that it has, if it has no medical use, it's in Schedule 1, doesn't mean that if it has a medical use, it can't be in Schedule 1 under Oregon law. Basically, that's what the Court of Appeals said. As my friend and colleague remarked, it's been 11 years since the passage of the Medical Marijuana Act, and it's been 4 years since a significant reform came out of this building, Senate Bill 1085. Among other things, 1085 passed in 2004 or 2005. Created a advisory committee for the Department of Human Services. I served on the first, I was the lawyer on the first batch of people who were on the advisory committee. Mr. Michaels currently holds that seat. But while in that position, I championed a resolution to advise the Director of Human Services of the Department of Human Services to recommend to the Department of to the Board of Pharmacy that they reschedule, and no action was taken, whether it was because the, I don't recall honestly whether it was because the director didn't follow through with what the advisory committee had recommended, which is typical for the director of the Department of Human Services, and one reason why I'm not on the advisory committee anymore, or whether the Board of Pharmacy had refused to do it. But the point is that I've personally been involved in both judicial and administrative efforts to make this change, to acknowledge that cannabis is medicine. It's a scientific fact. This would make it, I think, a legal fact. I think it is of great symbolic importance that the legislature take this step, and I'm hopeful that we don't have to wait another 25 years before there's recognition that what we're talking about when we're talking about cannabis is a non-toxic herbal remedy that shouldn't be scheduled at all, and that I hope that it doesn't take another 25 years and the economy getting worse and worse and worse and worse before the legislature decides that the economy is at a state where the government ought to figure out a revenue stream, either from the dispensing of medical cannabis to patients so that there can be an adequate supply through Senate Bill 812 this session or through the initiative
in 2010. Lee, I'm going to ask you to wrap
up. Almost done. I promise.
God love, the thing is you're going into bills that aren't before this committee.
I understand, but I wanted to...
Well, I'm making sure I'm understood. I need you to testify on what's before us, Senate Bill 285. And if you have any other comments on that, that's fine. If not, then we'll let John speak, because I've still got other people that may want to speak.
Sure. I'm just I'm glad for this step forward, Chair Przanski. I'm glad for the opportunity to address the committee. I urge the committee to pass it on to the floor, and I thank you for your patience with me.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is John Sager. I'm the Executive Director of Voter Power. We are an organization that assists patients with the medical marijuana law, and we do support Senate Bill 285. We think it's an important step that makes Oregon law consistent with itself. From our point of view, the debate over whether marijuana is medicine was settled a long time ago. We now have over 3,000 doctors in the state of Oregon that have qualified one or more patients for this program. That seems to me prima facie evidence that it does have accepted medical use. I would also ask you to consider moving it to Schedule 3 or higher. Marinol is scheduled under Schedule 3 at the federal level, and we don't see how the active ingredient could be in Schedule 3, but the natural plant material that creates that active ingredient could be in a more restrictive schedule. So I would encourage you to look at that. So again, we do support the bill, and I thank you for taking up this, what we hope is a housekeeping measure, And I would also second Mr. Berger's comments that, you know, I hope we can get on to the bigger issues, because, you know, I've been living in Oregon for 35 years and coming to this legislature virtually every session, and there's never really been a review of the laws that prohibit marijuana in general that complicate the lives for patients and I think make it harder to actually get a handle on our criminal justice problem. And I would encourage you to, I read an editorial by Senator Webb of Virginia yesterday calling for a review of our entire criminal justice system, and I hope at the state level we could do something like that, because, you know, we've gone from the world's freest country to being the world's biggest incarcerator, and I don't feel any safer because of that. So
thank you, John. Any questions, Senator Lissett?
Just one quick question, Senator Brzezinski. We are talking about medical marijuana here, and the question for the panel is, do you think that the schedule should be set by the legislature or by the Board of Pharmacy?
Could I respond first to that? Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, I think it has to be set by the legislature because the courts aren't going to do it and the board isn't going to do it on its own. So, and there's only three branches of government. I mean, I guess we could go by initiative.
If the legislature were to authorize the Board of Pharmacy to set the schedule, then they would set the schedule. So the question is, do you think it should be set by the legislature or by the Board of Pharmacy?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, if the legislature were to leave it to the board to reschedule, the board, in my estimation, would take no action.
Well, I think the question is, if we gave the policy we want this to be rescheduled and did not let's say state that it should be scheduled two, but allow them to schedule it within the range 2, 3, 4, 5, that's I think the question that's being asked.
Yes. Well, I don't think this bill would prohibit what the chair just said. Would not prohibit the Board of Pharmacy to schedule it at any higher level, at a 3 or 4.
Yeah, but the way it's currently written, the way I read it, shall be at that schedule. Yeah. And so we could, in fact, have an amendment that would basically give them the flexibility, based on the testimony we've heard, as to where the synthetic is currently scheduled, and allow them to make a determination, should it be a 2, should it be a 3, a 4, or 5, or whatever.
Provided that the legislature said that it needs to be rescheduled off of Schedule 1, it needs to be 2 or higher. Mm-hmm. I just said that. I just wanted to make sure I understood what you said.
Any other questions? Because not.
I think that would be reasonable.
Thank you all.
I have a question for Paige.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm trying to get her up. Yeah. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Paige, Clark, is there anyone else besides Paige that wanted to give testimony today? Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski and members of the committee. My name is Paige Clark. I'm the pharmacist consultant on staff with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. And our executive director is on furlough this morning and asked me to be here in his absence. So I have just a very brief statement to bring to you this morning. While the Oregon Board of Pharmacy is neutral on the concept, it strongly recommends further clarification because the board offers a suggestion that defining medical marijuana as a Schedule II in rule will allow language development to fit the needs of Oregon's medical marijuana program needs best without accelerating any potential complications with federal entities. Our executive director, Gary Schnabel, offered proposed rule language that defines medical marijuana as a Schedule II in Oregon and limits it to medical use only within Oregon's medical marijuana program. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Paige, could you describe how general classification is done and how changes to classification are done, sort of on the big picture scale for me, please?
I'll do my best. Yes, medications are classified Schedule 2 through 5 based on a variety of guidances. The FDA, the DEA classifies these, et cetera, and medications fall into these categories based on the components of the medications. And a variety of considerations go into that, Senator Bonamici.
I think what I'm looking for is the procedure. Is that typically done by the Board of Pharmacy? Is it ever done by legislative direction?
I don't know the answer to that because I do not know of it having been done specifically by the legislature.
Thank you.
The Board of Pharmacy does classify medications into those categories, if that answers your question.
And how typically are they changed? Are the classifications changed?
Very rarely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a quick question. Is there a problem if the state and federal governments have different marijuana on different schedules?
Senator Dingfelder and Chair Prozanski, that can occur. That can occur.
So a follow-up?
You may.
Yeah, so is this, does this occur for other drugs as well? That's what I'm trying to ask. Is there a precedent here?
Let me get back to you on that, with some specific information for you, Senator. Thank you.
Now, let me follow up on that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing from my understanding that prohibits a state under their scheduling to be out of sync as what the federal schedules may have. Check.
Chair Prozanski, that would be correct.
Yeah, and so basically what we have here is why this is coming forward is we, and I'm not sure how many states now, 13, 14 states, whatever the number is, that have actually had, through probably the initiative process, the voters have determined that marijuana has some medicinal use, and so now we're out of sync with what the voters have done. And so it may be that we're in conflict, just as we are right now, as to under the previous administration, they were going in and taking much more aggressive stands in those states that were recognizing medical marijuana as a medical purpose as compared to what we now hear what the administration is going to do. And it's quite possible that we're going to see on the federal level at some time in the near future a rescheduling at that level, because I know that has been addressed or let's say attempted to be addressed over a number of years in the past. So, anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you happen to know if those other states have rescheduled into Schedule 2? You mentioned the 13 or 14 other states.
Yeah, I personally don't know that.
Right. Senator Bonamici, I'd be glad to get that information back to you if that would be useful.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today? With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 285. I want to thank everyone for being here, and we're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:30. Mm-hmm. And with that, we're adjourned.